You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Sure, everyone here is fanatical about architecture.
Are you kidding? No, most people, they don't really have any idea. I mean, they know some things, but they don't really give a shit.
Is that right?
Yeah. You'd be surprised how little people know or care about architecture here.
Maybe not.
What do you mean?
I'm just like everyone here. You grow up around something and it feels like nothing.
What's up, everyone? I'm your host, Aisha Harris, and welcome back to Represent. On today's episode, you'll get to hear a very film geeky conversation I had with video essayist turned feature filmmaker Koganada, in which we discussed a lot of things, including his debut film, Columbus, starring John Cho, which is out in theaters this weekend. But before we get into that, I wanted to briefly discuss something really cool with Verilyn here.
Hi.
Hey. Welcome, Verilyn. Side note, if you're not checking out her wonderful section of the podcast.
Yeah.
The special series.
The
special series, the special bachelorette series. You should check it out.
Represent Rose.
Yes. The finale is coming very soon.
So, yes. I'm trying to get Aisha to join us in that. We'll see what happens.
I haven't been watching any of it, but
it'll require you to listen to the three parts that are out so far and then watching the finale.
Well, yes, I've listened to the last two, just not the most recent one.
Okay.
Okay.
Yay.
But anyway, Verilyn's here because we wanted to just briefly discuss something that a listener brought to my attention a little while back via email, Meg in Philadelphia.
Thank you, Meg.
Yeah. Thank you, Meg. She gave me permission to mention her and mention this lovely thing she sent me, which is called The Upward Path, A Reader for Colored Children. It's a book that was put together by academics Myron T. Pritchard, a school principal in Boston, and Mary White Ovington, who was chair of the NAACP at the time, and it was published in 1920. You can find it online. We'll include a link to it on the show page. Mm-hmm. We also have already put it up on our Facebook page, so you can check it out there. And there's a bunch of different poems and stories in this book from such luminaries as Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Phyllis Wheatley. But the one that she sort of singled out for me is called The Black Fairy, and it's by Fenton Johnson, who is a poet. And it's a really lovely little short story.
I really enjoyed it. I read it. First of all, my commute is very short, thank God.
Yay!
And so I was able to read it on my way in this morning. And I was just like, ugh, like as a person that like I, oh crap, what's the name of this book? She was a Peter Pan.
Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace.
Okay, so it's so funny that you brought that up because I was actually going to bring that up too.
I love this story.
Yes, my parents bought that for me. I was probably like in kindergarten, first grade or whatever. I remember that the cover was like, it had like a blue border because like all the books back then had like borders around them. Remember the children's books? And then it's just her like beautiful brown face grinning.
Yeah.
But anyway, Amazing Grace.
Yeah, and I literally bought... I heard someone talking about it on a podcast and I was like, oh my God, I love this book. And so I bought like four copies because I have an Amazon problem. I went on Amazon and I ordered like four copies and I've been giving it to my little cousins. Aww. And I'm going to give it to my niece for her birthday. And yeah, it's like it just like she. So the story is that she's she wants to play Peter Pan and the white girl is telling her she can't be Peter Pan because she's black. And then the boy is telling her she can't be Peter Pan because she's a girl.
Which, of course, for the record, Peter Pan has almost always been played by women.
I mean, and also it's a person that can fly. Like,
yes.
What?
Yeah, that too.
So as far as like that story stuck with me because here was this black little girl at the center of this story. And besides that, I'm really hard pressed to think about other children's books with that being the case.
I mean, I remember there being a lot of children's books that my parents gave to me that were very specifically like, because this was I was born in the end of the 80s, going into 90s. Mm-hmm. So there's like very much like, you know, the black, black power, not the black power movement, but like the sort of African
literary.
And so like I remember getting like sort of like those children's books, biography books that were about like Bessie Coleman all of that. And I also remember Tar Beach. You remember Tar Beach?
I know the cover. The cover's in my head, but I don't remember the story.
I vaguely remember the story, but I just remember it was Tar Beach was like the rooftop. They would hang out at the rooftop in New York City. I think it was New York City. And it was just like beautifully illustrated.
I never associated that with black characters for some reason.
Oh, they were black. And it was Tar Beach was Faith Ringgold. And it was beautifully illustrated. It was like, I think it was more picture book. Like there were some words, but I'm showing her the cover.
Yes.
Remember? It's so gorgeous.
I do remember this cover for sure.
And it reminds me because my aunt is a quilter. And so like the patterns reminded me of her quilts. Mm. Anyway, we digress.
Yes.
The whole point is to say that like, you know, we to some extent were starved for images of people who look like us.
Oh, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. Remember that?
Yeah, that I think I read them like third or fourth grade.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, I mean, of course, we're going to get to the Black Fairy. But all of those stories are all about like very tied into American racial politics in some way. At least I'm thinking about Amazing Grace. You can't do this because you're black and a woman.
And Roll of Thunder,
Hear My Cry, which is obviously about like racial tensions.
That was set like there were sharecroppers, right?
Yeah, there were sharecroppers, and I remember a fire.
Yeah, there's a fire. There's also the sequel, which is like Let the Circle Be Unbroken. Mm. There's at least one other book, right?
But this one has nothing to do with that.
No. The Black Fairy is different in that, you know, we are talking as kids of the late 80s, early 90s, whereas The Black Fairy, this was part of a collection of stories from 1920. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about, like, how far back this goes. And that's the point that Meg, in her email to me, made. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, this is crazy. So essentially, the story, The Black Fairy, a little girl named Annabelle is lying on the lawn. And she's reading a volume of Grimm fairy tales. And she's like 9 years old. And apparently she's the daughter of a colored lawyer. This was 1920 after all. And the prettiest dark child in the village. Yeah. that's what they say. And so she's reading Grimm's fairy tales, but she's like, they're like, I wish I had someone who looked like me. Like, is there a colored fairy out there? And then, lo and behold, the colored fairy shows
appears.
And then this colored fairy essentially gives her like a history lesson about Ethiopia.
This is like, and like Ghana.
Yeah, we should also remind, like, this is the time of also like Marcus Garvey and that sort of like the Back to Africa movement. So you have that to consider. So she's talking about the kings and the queens and how, you know, they lived in relative prosperity, which I think is sort of like, you know, not everyone was a king and queen in Africa, but, you know,
they were clearly superior. Like,
yeah,
there's a sense of like, you know, this is who you come from and they were the shit, and know that you come from people that are superior than every other people.
Yes, very much so. So, you know, it in a way, it's a little not hotepy, but
there's definitely some Hotep-ish things in there.
Yes.
But there's also like beautiful, like, you know, I didn't know that Fenton Johnson was a poet. And that makes so much sense because there's some beautiful language I highlighted. And she dropped a tear, so beautiful, the costliest pearl would seem worthless beside it. There's like a lot of imagery going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you definitely, I feel like this, like if it was in one of my African-American classes in college, like we would have spent like a whole class on that one sentence.
Yes. suffice to also say that I think that what really just struck me is how history is just always happening. Like it's just, for better or for worse, it's repeating itself. And I think that I hope that this helped some black and brown kids in 1920. I had the same sort of things, you know, that like I mentioned earlier, that my parents gave me those books that were very like, you know, black is beautiful, like a lot of black is beautiful. That was like, black is beautiful. We're going to keep telling you that over and over. anything with like brown girl in the title. Like,
And I feel like I'm doing that now for my little cousin and my niece.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to. It's because, I mean, even now, yes, there are way more images. And like, I think about it and sometimes I go back and I'm like, well, you know what? I was starved for images, but I wasn't at the same time. Like, I had it better than my parents did because, like, you go back and you look at stuff like TGIF, and I mean, some of those depictions were problematic, but they were still there. And we talked about it. But, like, you know, we had Sister Sister. We had, you had, like, Laura, who was a dark-skinned girl on Family Matter who, like, men wanted to be. So, like, we had those things. Mm-hmm. But, like, even now when little kids have, like, my younger sisters who are very young, you know, they have Doc McStuffins, the show with a little girl who's, like, a doctor. But you still have to push back against it because it's still out there that black is not as prized as whiteness.
So I'm going to share this story and I'll cut it just in case my sister is like, don't you share this. But I don't think she'd mind. So my sister has vitiligo. And so the pigmentation in her skin is like very, very, very fair. Mm-hmm. And so my niece... My sister was telling me my niece got into an argument with kids in her school. So over the summer, she's going to some program that's different than her regular school. And in this school, they see my sister and they're like, oh, your mom is white. And my niece got into an argument. She's like, no, my mom is black. I was like cringing at the idea that like she even had to like have this conversation, because it's like one of those like useless conversations, because you don't want to like give credence to this conversation in general, right? Like the idea of like colorism, you don't want to go there. But I was like so proud of her to just be like, no, I'm black, my mama's black, we black, and there's nothing wrong with that. In some way, like, this is why we have to keep reinforcing it, because at all levels they get challenged, because like we internalize so much of this stuff and we pass it on to young people without even knowing it.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that so much of it is subconscious. Mm-hmm. And it takes years to undo that. It took me years to undo that. Anyway,
I mean, Lisa Turtle, to this day I'm just like, yo, why was it that she never was in like a serious relationship?
That made zero sense. Yeah. Especially since Lisa Turtle, by like anyone's standards,
it's way is better than pretty... Kelly Kapowski. We're talking about Saved by the Bell, if anyone doesn't know.
Lars Voorhees. Or Lark Voorhees.
Hope she's okay wherever she is right now.
Yeah, I think she's fine. I think she's doing better than Stacey Dash.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anywho, thank you, Meg, for sending us this really lovely story, and everyone should check it out. And yeah, just think about the things that you're passing on to the younger generation.
Yeah. And if there's any listeners that have recommendations for other books and titles that we missed out on, that maybe they should turn into a TV show or movie or a cartoon, or maybe they should leave it alone, whatever, just hit us up at represent@slate.com.
And now, director Koganada and I talk about his first film, Columbus. So if you're a cinephile and appreciate older movies, like myself, there's a chance you've seen his work already online. He's done some visually stunning and inquisitive video essays focusing on filmmaking and auteurs like Ozu and Richard Linklater. Now, with Columbus, he's taken on being behind the camera and brought some excellent actors with him. John Cho plays Jin, who is in town to look after his estranged father after he falls ill. And Haley Lou Richardson is Casey, a young woman stuck in Columbus due to her sense of obligation to take care of her drug-addicted mother. Jin and Casey strike up a friendship that takes them deep into philosophical queries as it relates to Columbus's existence as a surprisingly huge architectural hub. Koganada talked about his love of movies, the difficulties of trying to sell a film with an Asian lead, and the story behind his mysterious moniker. Check it out. Well, it is my pleasure to welcome to the studio today. We have Koganada. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, it's funny because we've published a few of your video essays or reposted them on the site. And they tend to do really great. And we'll get a little bit more into that. I want to ask you some questions about that later. But first, I want to find out exactly how you went from being this sort of film editor of video essays to making the leap to this first feature film.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's sort of a history of people who are doing like film criticism or film writing who also really want to make films. And I think that was always the case. Once this sort of possibility of working and offering some take on cinema, but doing it by cutting and recutting and mixing the cinematic form, that even made it feel closer, right? Because I was actually working on cinema in that way. Mm-hmm. So, that was always the desire. And there was probably some quiet ambition about that. And as I had more opportunity, there was a moment where some people had asked if I was ever going to do something longer. Mm-hmm. And I think that planted a seed in my head to say, if I'm going to do this, I need to do it. And so I started writing a script. You know, I had tons of notes on other, you know, film ideas that I would one day, you know, hopefully do. And so that's how it came together.
Yeah. So how exactly did you fall upon this story in particular? Like, I see a lot of elements, and other people have noticed elements from, you know, some of the filmmakers who I think I know you admire, and like Ozu and Linklater. But, you know, where did this story come from? Because it feels familiar, but then it also feels very different.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. I definitely have influences and I hope it shows. But I think, you know, I knew that I wanted to do a story about the burden children feel in regard to their parents, especially this sort of sense of departure, mm-hmm. either that they're aging or they're, and you feel that vulnerability, and however you feel about your parents, you have to deal with that loss. Mm-hmm. And then also from the perspective of someone who's younger, who's going to have to say bye to their parents, that first bye that they ever have to do. I think I knew that my first film was going to explore that kind of departure. And mm-hmm. and really, it wasn't until I visited Columbus that it really gave it some structure and fleshed it out. Like, once I knew the place, it really brought everything to life. So
this is Columbus, Indiana.
Columbus,
not
Indiana.
Not Columbus, Ohio, which
That's right.
was my original thought. Now, first of all, why were you in Columbus, Indiana?
Yeah, that's a good question. I grew up in the Midwest. So I had passed probably that exit, you know, mm-hmm. hundreds of times, but never knew about it until I read an article in the New York Times. And I think the NPR also did a piece on it. I think what had happened was they had just been ranked one of the top 10 architecturally significant cities in America by the AIA. And I think it was a surprise to everyone because, you know, it was like San Francisco and New York and Chicago and then this little town of 45,000.
Right.
And when I read that, these little features, I was like, what in the world? You know, so it was really out of a kind of curiosity to say, like, what, you know, this sounds like, you know, a town I definitely want to see. It's about all these sort of modern architects that I adore. And I had no idea that this little town existed. Yeah.
So you're drawn to architecture. Like, that's something you're very, very interested in.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think in general, like, I think modern art forms speak to me a certain way because I think it's trying to address the loss of meaning in the modern world. And I think the modernism itself is wrestling with that question. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been interested in that question.
Mm-hmm. It's also, isn't this where Mike Pence is from, or he lives, or?
Yeah.
That's, okay.
Yeah, no, he was born there. He grew up there.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And at the time, you know, once we were shooting it, then, you know, we found out that he was going to be the vice president. But we all thought, oh, that's not going to be so relevant. You know, he's going to lose, and you know, but it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the architecture, the thing about shooting, it's one thing to take photos of architecture, but it's another to try and like write a film that's very much heavily like the architecture is part of the mise-en-scene, is part of all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, did you come up against any challenges of how to make the architecture come alive in that way?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's such a good point. I mean, I think that one advantage that I think I had, because I love architecture and I love photos of architecture, but it always flattens out the space and it becomes this sort of art object. The beautiful thing about architecture is I really do feel like it's the art of space and really it's a space that we can encounter and engage and inhabit. It's very different than any other art form. Because, you know, usually they are just these sort of objects that you stand off, but you work and move through architecture, and it's always changing. And so just by having, like, bringing the architecture to life by putting it in the context of a narrative was already this thing that I knew was going to alter our relationship with these buildings, you know, and that it was really important for me, not just in its composition, but to really make sure that the human beings kind of warm that space up because they are struggling in the context of these buildings and moving through them. But in regard to that space, we did want to open it up. We wanted us to feel the space. Mm-hmm. And we did limit our movement just because we wanted it to reside, you know, and feel grounded and give us time really to also kind of feel that space.
Yeah, there's a lot of stationary camera happening.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, also feels very Ozu in a way. But yeah, I noticed that it's very... It's not a still movie, but it's definitely not the camera's not always wrapping around and moving.
That's right.
And all that stuff.
Yeah. And I think we knew that from the get-go, that it was going to be a lot of lockdown shots. And mm-hmm. we knew that there would be some movement, but we were going to be really careful about when and, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, with regards to casting John Cho, you wrote this, and as I understand it, you wrote it with Asian lead in mind, correct?
Right. Well, you know, I think I started with knowing that it was going to be someone from overseas.
Okay.
But
yeah.
it only took me a few seconds to realize, like, I'm going to write him Asian, you know?
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, while the movie doesn't have a quote-unquote message per se, it's mm-hmm. definitely like... There are very culturally specific moments.
Absolutely.
With, you know, John Cho's character, Jin, constantly on the phone. There's no subtitles.
Right.
Speaking in Korean.
Yeah.
There's a few, like, asides of him mentioning his ethnicity.
Yeah.
There's that when he first meets, what is her name?
Eleanor. Or no.
Casey.
Casey, yeah.
Yes.
You speak English.
You don't think Asians can speak English?
Yeah, of course. No, yeah. I heard you speaking on the phone and I...
Sorry, I'm being a jerk. You offered me a cigarette and I'm giving you a hard time.
I didn't mean to.
I know what you meant.
When he first meets Casey, played by Haley Lou Richardson, she says something, and he's like, "Oh, so you assume this because I'm Asian or something?" And then he's like, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm being a dick, but still."
Right.
But there's those moments, and you know, this is a very small movie. Mm-hmm. I know how the industry works.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to pitch this movie and even get it made, having an Asian lead specified?
Yeah, I mean, it was, so, you know, I may have been naive because I watch a lot of international cinema. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of diversity and and I think the film community that I interact with, that's common, and everyone knows Asian actors and their favorites and all of that.
Yeah.
So I think bringing this in, and especially someone like John Cho is probably one of the most well-known Asian American actors. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised at how it was. There were financiers who pretty much said there's no market value for an Asian man, and just was very dismissive.
Even with John Cho? Was he on board before?
Yeah. Okay, he was on board, but they just basically said, there's no value, which was, you know, not everyone, but there was definitely a number of financiers who pretty clearly just said there's no value.
Hmm.
And so that... You know, that was eye-opening. And I think there was even some, like, if you would consider changing, you know, him, you know, and of course it's not so common or uncommon. And I, you know, I've heard that on radio shows or podcasts of people having that sort of experience. So I don't know why it was so eye-opening, but it was, you know.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, when you're on the receiving side of it and it's reduced to that, to some, like, imagined sense of value, it is something that makes you pause and you know. But on the other hand, you know, when you find someone like a Chris Weitz, who was the person who said we should cast John Cho,
mm-hmm.
and was always behind it, and then, you know, ultimately we found Danielle, and she also knew Chris, but she read the script and was so, you know, supportive of it and had zero questions about that. You know,
and Chris White is he's
one of the producers.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Got it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he has worked with John. You know, he's mm-hmm. a big Hollywood mm-hmm. producer. But yeah, and he, I think, is championing that. And that's, you know, partly why we, I was able to make also a very sort of distinct film that is its own thing, is we had someone like him who was just going to protect it. And Daniel as well, you know, who really brought in the money to finance it, was really about protecting this vision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did that, like, when you're hearing that, that an Asian lead doesn't have any value, like, how does that make you feel just on a, like, gutter, like, setting aside the artistic,
right,
the feelings about that, like, did it hurt? Was it disappointing? Like,
yeah. I mean, I think there's a point that it just sounds ridiculous to me. You know, I mean, I understand the way in which, and I, you know, truthfully, I mean, I think whether you're an Asian actor or a Black actor or you're even a white actor, the way in which all actors are quantified
by
value. Literally, someone told me there's some kind of book in which you know, you can, like, kind of identify actors and what they're going to bring in.
With, like, specific people's names?
I think so. Or you know, I don't
or
know.
Or types.
That was,
yeah.
But it was, like, that sort of reduction of humanity. I mean, it's literally quantifying human beings into a number is to me, ridiculous. You know, and it's, like, some sort of desire to you know, turn everything into a formula. And so there's a part of me that doesn't believe it, so it's easy for me to dismiss. Does it, like, am I taken aback by it? And as an Asian male, and, you know, there's all kinds of cultural indicators that suggest that maybe tries to reinforce that idea, you know? But there's probably a little bit of hurt, but it would hurt more if I believed it. If, you know, I just think it's, like, a ridiculous reduction of human beings. It seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah, just a few weeks ago, we actually discussed the whole Hawaii Five-O thing,
right,
where that was just another example of, like, how it brought up all these complications about how we quantify actors, and especially how we quantify, you know, Asian actors who ostensibly in a show set in Hawaii should be mostly South Pacific.
That's absolutely,
you know,
right.
Yeah.
And you know, it is this sort of thing where, and I know people have said this before, but maybe they have a show or something and it doesn't register or doesn't bring in money. And so they base every judgment on that. But, you know, as people have said, there have been so many shows with, like, white actors that have failed. And, you know, that never discourages. But it takes one, you know, show or one film in which they don't feel like it has market value. And they use that formula for everything, which, again, is really, I think it's really easy to reveal the falsehood of that kind of, you know, assessment. And we've seen the opposite. We've seen, like, films that star women and Black women. Like, we're seeing that. And it's, like, really successful, but that's not necessarily going to, you know, encourage that sort of, although I do think, with that said, I mean, I do think things are changing. You know?
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, it just is, it's crazy to me because, you know, like you were saying, you watch a lot of international cinema. You're a film nerd. You are a cinephile. Like, that's what you are.
Uh-huh.
And it's weird to me because whenever I speak with film nerds and you know, I went to film school and, like, we had to watch a bunch of, you know.
Wait, you're a film nerd.
Yes. No, I say it in a way, and I say it in a, you know.
So you don't just speak to film nerds. You are a film nerd.
Yes, I can tell. So, like, you know, I watched Ozu. We watched, you know, Miyazaki, all that, like, all of that stuff. And those are typically, even if you think about Sight and Sound, the Sight and Sound poll every 10 years. Like, there's always so many Asian, mostly Asian, not Asian American, but Asian auteurs.
Yeah.
On those lists, and yet somehow still they consider it, like, not marketable.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that it's a little bit different because these are smaller movies. They're not making as much money. But then you have someone like Wes Anderson. I mean, he's had bigger hits recently, but, like, his early movies were really small.
Right.
So
Yeah. And I don't think it's just about, you know, diversity. I feel really hopeful in the sense that we've seen in America how food culture has changed. You know, I think there was, you know, 20 years ago, people had pretty bland taste, and it was like this kind of whatever version of American food was this sort of middle, you know, American food.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've said this before, but I remember very, when I was young, this idea of sushi, and people would say raw fish, and it was just like...
I still say that.
Yeah.
I don't like sushi.
Okay.
But I get it.
Yeah. But it's funny. Like, you can go to, like some really redneck area of the South, and there are people eating sushi.
Oh, yeah.
And that you know, that there is this sort of like growing palette of different ethnic foods that people are beginning to get excited about and talk about. It just there has to be a moment where people are willing to take that risk. And that's why I think in some ways this question of diversity, which I think is so valuable and important, but it's also not just a numbers game. Like, I don't want it, like, you know, if I can just keep using the food analogy, you know, it's like it's an important discussion to say, OK, how many, like, if this one kitchen only hires like white chefs and white cooks, then that's a problem. Like, you have to change those numbers because that's a problem. But if you get people in there and they're just all making the same thing, it's just like now you've taught all these like diverse people who are now working in the kitchen, but they're still making this kind of very generic or just this one kind of food. You know, it's important to get people to be able to cook, but we are also offering sensibilities. You know, it's like it's the paucity of cinema in America that we don't have not just these directors, but it's equally important that they're not just making the same product, but that they are infusing it with their culture. You know, it really is, we'll have a richer palette of cinema if we get people in there who's not just making what has been made before and we're just happy if we're able to play that game, but that we are really going to enhance cinema, as you said, because, you know, there's this international palette that we've tasted of, and I think it will. I do have to believe that it's going to happen here, you know, and it's happening. I think so.
Yeah. I mean, I know you've also said that one of the things that drew you to Columbus was the idea that, like, there's a very modern, the tension between modernity, but then also, like, the Western values that modernity often encompasses, and how you kind of wanted to get away from that. Could you speak a little bit more?
Yeah, well, it's just that, you know, for the longest time, and it has changed, certainly in the academia has changed, but there used to be a reduction of modernity to Westernization. When you talked about being modern, people were like, oh, you're talking about being Western. And so often when you talked even about, even in the realm of, I think, modern art, it was highly defined through the history of Western thought, through the history of Western ideas and Western art. But now, you know, and certainly this academia accepts this reality that there are modernities, and when the modern world hit other cultures, it didn't play out the same way, and other cultures have a different kind of past, and breaking from those pasts are quite different, you know, and that's certainly true for Eastern and Asian cultures.
So I've read somewhere that I know this is your first feature film, but this was also like your first time being on a set, correct? Or at least like directing a set.
Certainly, yeah, that scale, yeah.
What was it like that first day on set? And then by the end of it, how do you think you had changed? Or was there anything specific that you really took away from this experience that you didn't have from your video essays?
Yeah. Well, certainly it was humbling in the way that, you know, from like a film theory or film critic point of view, you just, you know, and when you're analyzing films, you in your head, no matter what you hear, you have this ideal scenario that a film should do these certain things without constant obstacles from financing to the day. And so it's very easy to take apart a film and just say, well, why didn't they do this, you know, without knowing all the factors. So it's really humbling for film theory to meet practice and the nuts and bolts of it. But that was a really beautiful experience. I mean, I think I was happy to encounter all the nuts and bolts of filmmaking and what why we see what we see. But I have heard filmmakers say, oh, it's harder for me to judge other films now because it's such an accomplishment to get any film finished. And I can fully understand that sort of that idea. So I think part of it was a kind of humility for the practice. I have said before that working with the actors was the unknown for me. Like, you know, I think I had thought so much about the form of cinema, but that was such a delight. It was almost a surprising, beautiful thing to see them do their craft, to talk to them about it. It gave me a deep respect for that medium as well. And yeah, I'm real excited to do that again. if I had the chance. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
as do you want to be a filmmaker? Do you have that in you?
I could see I've played with the idea of like writing for film, mm-hmm. but not necessarily making. I don't think I have the patience for that. I've been on a film set before, yeah, and like the number of takes just to get like 20 seconds of film.
Right.
It's just like I can't do it. But like I could see myself maybe writing a screenplay at some point.
I could see that.
Yeah.
You should do that.
I need to just do it.
You need to do it. You do need to do it.
All right. Well, if enough people tell me, just like enough people told you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You need to do it.
So I actually want to get into the video essays now because I feel like they've become such a part of our culture now, especially with YouTube. And, you know, there's a difference, I think, between a supercut, which were very prolific for a little while. Mm-hmm. I feel like we don't see them as much anymore. Is sort of a genre, and working as someone who's been blogging about culture for a few years now, like I saw that rise, and now I'm kind of seeing it. Things get a little bit more sophisticated in the way that people are discussing film.
Right.
So with regards to the video essay, do you look at it as like a genre and one, you know, like an art form in the same, not in the same way as film, but like an aspect of that?
Yeah, I mean, I do see, I am not, there have been people who have really articulated this form and the and what it is and what it isn't. And I have never wanted to define it for myself. I didn't know fully what I was making. I just knew I wanted to make something. Mm-hmm. And I don't still, you know, I don't think about like, I do think, you know, to create too many boundaries at this point would be disappointing, you know, because we are at this moment where we have this possibility of making something and distributing it ourselves. Yeah, so I'm hesitant to try to say what that is. I will tell you that when I was making it, initially it was other things that I was starting to see online that was really engaging to me. And it was like, I think when we saw the rise of that, we were also seeing the rise of other things online that were really aesthetic, that was really capturing people's attention. And these things would have only existed in museums and galleries. There would be no place for anyone to make something that short and show it.
Right.
And I remember just feeling, I remember that moment when I thought online videos were mostly home videos and then realizing, oh, people are putting stuff out here that is, you know, it's mesmerizing, it's art.
Yeah.
And it was really inspiring to think, oh, you can now make short things that have no, there would be no other place for it. And so because I loved cinema, you know, it made me immediately think about, well, what can we do here? And
it is really fascinating to me. I feel like that's a good point you make about how before they were just in museums and that sort of thing. I think the first sort of video, not really an essay, but sort of like a montage, I guess. I remember Turner Classic Movies. Here I am being a nerd again. when I was like in middle school, they had this, and I don't remember who made it, but it celebrated 100 years of cinema. And so it went from the beginning of, you know, the silent films the D.W. Griffith, and then up to, I think it was made in like the early 90s or late 80s, so it only went so far.
Right.
But I just remember like being mesmerized by that sort of montage and like the feeling and the way that it was cut with the music and like the clips, like the sound clips of different movies. I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. Yeah. And now you see that, you can see all different versions of that on the internet.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. Right. I remember that too. And it was, you know, you think about it. Like, I don't think, you know, in many ways, if the climate didn't exist, why would I, you know, make that unless I had this real ambition to get someone to represent me or to find a gallery, which, you know, I think that certainly happens. But to know that you could make something like that, here it's for TCM. And then, of course, I've been able to do work for Criterion and Sight and Sound. But even before then, you know, it was just that I could do it and put it out there. And it has encouraged a ton of people to really work on that medium. And who knows the end of that? You know, if we're already at the end or if it's just beginning. But But it's exciting that it's out there. And I do think the transition, you know, from video essayist or whatever that is to filmmaking is not, you know, I don't think I'm going to be the first and last person to do that.
Because
we've seen plenty of film critics who become filmmakers.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you consider there are so many people who just started off directing music videos and
right.
now they're making,
yeah,
I mean, to
right.
varying degrees of success.
Right. That's right.
But yeah, it does seem like a sort of natural leap in that way.
I think so.
Yeah. And I also just see the way in which you played with different, like, I think a lot of times when we think of video essay, we think it's always just someone talking at you and explaining things. And that is a lot of video essays. Mm-hmm. But like with the Ozu, the one where it was just different emotions.
Yeah, yeah.
I
like
forget
what
it was called.
The Way of Ozu.
The Way of Ozu, uh-huh. Yes. With that video essay, there's no dialogue. It's just, you know, three panels of and from different films of his. With the neorealism, when you're comparing,
yeah.
you know, De Sica's version of, I'm so terrible
yeah.
with names.
No, The Terminal Station.
The Terminal Station versus Indiscretion of an American Wife.
Right, right.
Selznick's version. Like, it's not, you're playing with the form in many different ways.
Yeah,
like, essay is a loose term
yeah.
for you.
And I like, you know, in general, I feel like I like written essays. And I think that there is a tradition where a written essay is exploratory. It's not like didactic or anything. It's more like a person who's trying to figure something out, mm-hmm. you know. It has that illusion of that. And I also was kind of coming from academia, so I was also trying to resist this, for me, like trying to teach something. I think one of the reasons why I realized, oh, I'm not going to be a good academic because my mind always changes on a subject. Mm-hmm. I sometimes week to week. And mm-hmm. I remember, you know, I got to teach a bit when I was in grad school, but, you know, I would teach something and the next week I would think, I don't think I believe that anymore, you mm-hmm. know? And so I'm always a little uncomfortable to say this is, you know, so even in some of the pieces that I've made that might even feel that way, I try to make it more like questionable, you know, because mm-hmm. I don't know if I know that it's a question that interests me, but I don't know if it's some answer or truth that I want to say, you know, it is the case.
Mm. Well, before we wrap up, I do want to ask you a bit. You've been asked this a lot, but about your name, Koganada. So I know that, you know, a few years ago you were less interested in, not that you're in the spotlight per se now,
no,
but
no.
you were very, you know, careful with your privacy
and
it was unclear like what you looked like or mm-hmm. whether you were a man, woman. So why, what has changed?
Yeah.
And Koganada is, as I understand it, it's a heteronym of Ozu's screenwriting partner.
Yeah, a little variation of that.
Koganoda?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
So, yeah, what? You don't have to tell us your real name,
no,
but like,
no.
How do you, what?
I'm really tempted to, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think at the time, you know, I've used pseudonyms before, like writing, and in part because, you know, I am like a lot of people who put things out in the public. You know, they can be the also people who are really self-critical or have some sort of neurotic relationship with that. And I do, to the point where, you know, I have a ton of work that I've done that I've never put out, work that probably is okay, but I'm really self-critical. Mm. And it was really stifling. You know, I was just getting older and not putting stuff out. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to, you know, there is something about, for me, the space of that, whatever that performance is that we do. And it was really freeing. And you know, I also have a bunch of heroes that I like who have, you know, from Chris Marker to Eric Romare, you know, these people who've used other names to give them, I think, that space and mm-hmm. privacy. And I think at the time, you know, I, if I was more thoughtful, like I thought, oh, this is going to lead to this and this is going to lead to this. It was just another name. And for I knew I was starting to do this visual work. And really, the only reason I even had it as one name is it visually, it was something that was very visual to me. Mm. The whole, like, I like the look of it. I like the, you know, the rhythm of it and all of it. you know, and that's just the way my head is. And so I mean, with that said, I really identify, you know, I really identify with certain, you know, names. And I think my own American name and my Korean name, you know, I'm a very much like caught in between worlds. So I never had a name that I fully identified with. My family doesn't call me by, they call me by a nickname that only they use. And my friends call me another nickname. So, my father was given a Japanese name when he was young and they were colonized. So names are interesting to me. They're political. They're malleable. So I've always felt that sort of relationship with names to be something a little bit playful, but a little bit, personal. Mm. So I've always wrestled with it a little bit. But it is funny. I think, it was going to be something visual. I for the longest time, thought, oh, I won't ever, because I'm not so interested in that. But once I really realized, oh, this is a possibility of making films. I knew that I had to be present. I knew I had to. I didn't want to be like Banksy. I don't have that. I didn't want to play that game. Yeah. So, which I mean, I think Banksy is amazing. So yeah. I don't.
But that feels like a lot of work.
I didn't want to do that.
And films are kind of different because you do need to promote them in some way.
Yeah. And the truth is, the reason why I want to make films is I love the conversation of cinema. I mean, I am desperate for, I love the conversation of cinema. It's like, I'm a really one-track person. Like if I'm in a party, it's hard for me to talk about anything else. But, if someone wants to talk about films or, life, philosophy, whatever, but there is something about that was what made me want to make films, to be a part of that conversation. So, it's a real treat.
Really quick, what is your favorite scene of 2017 so far?
My favorite scene?
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a good question.
I know, it's tough.
Oh, wow.
Because I'm sure you've watched so many movies this year.
Yeah. Well, what's on my mind right now, because I saw A Ghost Story and I'm trying to process that. Have you seen that?
Yes. it was a bit of a schlog for me, but.
Well, it's kind of stunning, right? It's stunning because I love that exists in many ways. I definitely do. And that is getting so much distribution. It's kind of crazy, but
yeah. Wait, is it the pie scene or is it
No. I don't know if that's the scene. I'm just like I think that's the very last thing I saw. So of course that's on my mind. But I know that there's a. But I'm trying to think, trying to be truthful. Like, what is seen as haunting me? Gosh, I wish we had time because I would love to dig into that and figure that out.
Hey, if you think of it, let us know. We can throw it on
at
the end.
I will.
Yeah.
I will.
Okay. Awesome. Well,
hey, are you going to start the movement of podcast host to screenwriter? Is that going to happen? And then will you let me interview you if that happens?
Yes.
Okay.
For sure.
That's the deal, right? I come back. Okay.
Yes. All right. We'll totally do it.
Okay. Very good.
So my last question, my very last question is, when is the last time you saw yourself on screen? So you felt as though you saw yourself in a character, in a motion. You felt represented in a way.
Oh, that's such a good question. I think once I put in my head that I was going to write an Asian male lead, because again, I didn't think like I'm going to write an Asian male lead and then try to come up with a story. Mm-hmm. I had a story and then I realized, oh, it's going to be an Asian male lead. And it was so exciting for me to think I could write someone that's me. So it's completely, advertising. But I really felt like the thing that I love about Jin is that he is talking about, he's struggling with existential things. He's wrestling with his father. He's thinking about art and all of those things, which a lot of Asian males that I know are that kind of, they're existential. A ton of them are existential. A ton of them love to talk about art and cinema and are kind of like the sort of Richard Linklater characters. There are a lot of Asian men who are like that, but mostly they are represented as either, that they know martial arts or they're some sidekick. But almost all of those, the Asian men I talk to are pretty sensitive, like wrestling with these big questions. So I was so excited to have someone who sort of just had conversations, like I you know, and tried to have meaningful conversations and, you know, and wrestling, just wrestling mm-hmm. with life. So can I say Jin from my film?
We usually make it something that you were not a part of.
That's better.
Yes. I like that description though.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you can give us like something you had nothing to do with.
Well, okay. So
and it doesn't have to be
an American film either,
no,
right?
No,
so like, you know, After the Storm by Koreeda Hirokazu. I think you know, and really honestly any film from Koreeda Hirokazu resonates with me because it's populated with people who are wrestling with family and wrestling with life. I'll say that.
Sounds good.
I feel bad because my mind has gone blank with all the really great films that I've seen this year, and I have felt so... I felt so encouraged. Can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah.
Do you feel... So I've had this conversation recently, you know, the ridiculous kind of conversation about the end of cinema. To me, it's so much like cinema to me feels like it's just beginning, that we have... You know, it's like if someone was saying, like, right before Jackie Robinson, really, that, oh, we're at the end of baseball, you know, because we've had a few... You know, we've had a many Babe Ruths in cinema, so I'm not trying to say that dismissive of that. But, I mean, I feel so encouraged by this new wave of Black African-American directors, of even female directors and even Asian directors. But do you feel hopeful in that way? Because, I mean, I'm looking at Jenkins and Coogler and, you know, we can just name them. And it feels different because obviously we've had, you know, the Spike Lees and other people. But does this feel different to you?
It definitely feels different, just because I do think that in a way Hollywood is seeing more commercial value in Black cinema than it ever has before. Obviously, we have the Blaxploitation era, and that was a very lucrative, but it was mostly white men behind the camera in those movies, and they weren't allowed to helm for the most part, aside from someone like... photographer. I'm so, Gordon Parks, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I do think it's whenever people talk about the end of things, like I just saw a headline, I didn't read it, but there's a headline in somewhere where they're talking about the end of rom-coms. I'm like, we're talking about this every 2 years.
Yeah,
like, it's not that it's the end. I don't think it's like the musical or the Western, which I think did have they died for a while and then like are sort of back in like different and interesting ways. But I don't think the rom-com will ever die.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think cinema is ever going to die. And I think that even just like the video, the fact that something like video essays and things that proliferate on the internet give people who might not be able to afford going to film school yet the tools to like use, you know, to figure things out for themselves and then maybe eventually become filmmakers.
Right.
The access is better.
Yeah.
I mean, even Spike Lee's always like, you know, we had, who was the one who directed Tangerine?
He just did.
And he has another film.
The Florida Project.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Sean Baker.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So Sean Baker, like Sean Baker who made a film. I mean, obviously post-production there was stuff, but like he made a film on an iPhone.
Right.
So
yeah.
I agree with you that
it's
I feel
beginning.
Like it's, yes, we're entering a new era, and I'm not concerned.
Yeah, no, I feel like, and maybe that we should stop talking about the end, but just talk it, like, is this the beginning of cinema? Because it feels like maybe we've just graduated from kindergarten,
maybe.
And we've had some really bright, you know, kindergartners, but I feel like it is, I'm really excited about that. Aziz, not just diverse voices, but these, like Ryan Coogler, who grew up in Oakland, but also knows international cinema, like as a film nerd.
Yeah.
Like when you start seeing those diverse people who've also have been feasting on international cinema and then seeing how that plays out into culture, like we've not, you know, again, it's like if people talked about baseball before we let everyone else play the game, it would be ridiculous to imagine that baseball was at its prime because we've not let everyone play this game yet.
That's such a good analogy.
And when they do, it's going to be like, oh, this is what like this game looks like. This is what it looks like at this level when everyone, and they've all digested this kind of, you know, the early cinema and international cinema. And so Jordan Peele, it feels like this last couple of years, these new voices, but voices that have also feasted on these voices that have existed, and but they're not letting go of their own culture. They're infusing it.
Right.
Man, I'm excited about that.
Good. We should all do so.
Okay. Very good.
Right. Thank you so much, Jordan.
Okay, thank you.
And scene. Represent is produced by the lovely, amazing Verilyn Williams. Our social media assistant is Marissa Martinelli. And our intro-outro music is performed by the sweet San Francisco funk soul band Midtown Social. And have you gotten your tickets to our next live show in NYC? As we've mentioned before, Represent will be part of the Speak Up, Rise Up Festival on August 16th, and I'm so excited to announce that joining me on the show are some amazing guests, including writer and trans activist Teek Milan, BuzzFeed's Bim Adewunme, and friend of the show, Antonia Cerejido. Tickets are available now, so you should grab them at slate.com/live. Also, if you are a fan of Represent, you will probably enjoy another Slate podcast, the Double X Gap Fest, which is a biweekly podcast that discusses feminism, gender, sexuality, and many other issues that are of interest to women and their friends. You can download and subscribe to the Double X Gap Fest wherever you find your podcasts, and every once in a while, you might even hear me on there. Until next time.